Today is Monday, October the 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. A month-long investigation by hundreds of journalists has uncovered vast amounts of wealth, including secret real estate holdings amassed by current and former leaders from around the world. The Algerian government has banned French military planes from its airspace amid a diplomatic crisis. But how will this move impact French military operations in the Sahel?
They say that it slightly impacts on their ability to be able to supply their troops who are stationed in northern Mali, but they say it will not affect operations.
Dubai's Expo 2020 World Fair opens its doors to the public with more than 190 countries exhibiting their culture and latest innovations.
To the gorgeous architectural work on each and every pavilion. I personally was dazzled as I walked through the pavilions.
And Chinese military flew 16 warplanes over waters south of Taiwan on Sunday as the United States expressed concern about what it called China's provocative military action near the self-governing island that China claims. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, a month-long investigation by hundreds of journalists has uncovered vast amounts of wealth, including secret real estate holdings amassed by current and former leaders from around the world. The documents, dubbed the Pandora Papers, exposed the offshore holdings of 35 current and former country leaders, including Russian President Vladimir Putin, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and Jordan's King Abdullah. The investigation of nearly 12 million documents from 14 sources was led by the Washington-based International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, with 650 journalists from around the world working on the project. The Washington Post, one of the news outlets that helped conduct the investigation, said that the files included private emails, secret spreadsheets, clandestine contracts, and other records that revealed financial schemes and who was behind them. For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, including podcasts of shows like Upfront, Africa 54 TV show, Straight Talk Africa, and many others. You can also connect with us on Twitter. Our handle is at @VOA_IE. That is @VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
With abortion on the line in the upcoming Supreme Court term, nationwide protests drew thousands to Washington and other cities on Saturday this weekend to demand continued access at a time when conservative lawmakers and judges have put it in jeopardy. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
In Cleveland, they chanted Save Roe in reference to the landmark Supreme Court case which made abortion legal. In Washington, they cheered for Planned Parenthood President Alexis McGill Johnson, who told the crowd this year nearly 600 restrictions have been introduced in 47 states.
No matter where you are, this fight is at your doorstep right now.
At a New York rally, Governor Hochul recounted how her own mother fought for abortion rights, and she's been in the same fight her whole life.
I'm sick and tired of having to fight over abortion rights. It's settled law in the nation.
At an unrelated event in Maine, Republican Senator Susan Collins said she's working with two Democrats and another Republican to make Roe versus Wade the law of the land. I'm Julie Walker.
And the new project aims to identify some of the hundreds of people who were involved in the 1965 voting rights protest known as Bloody Sunday. AP's Julie Walker joins us again.
That's when demonstrators who walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma were attacked by Alabama state troopers. Two Auburn University professors and some students have a Facebook page where people can look through photographs and identify themselves or others. The page, called Help Us Identify the Selma Bloody Sunday Foot Soldiers, has been online since August, but organizers need help promoting it. They say the project highlights the need for additional historical research for one of the most famous moments in American history. I'm Julie Walker.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Tensions have heightened between Algeria and France in response to comments by French President Emmanuel Macron, which Algeria are calling inadmissible. On Sunday, the Algerian government banned French military planes from its airspace, even though the spokesperson for the French armed services says that the closure would have no major consequences. Analysts say that it will undoubtedly have an impact on their operations in the Sahel region. To explain the spat between the two countries, I reached Catherine Field, a reporter and analyst based in Paris. Catherine, how did this all start?
It is alleged by the Algerian authorities that during a meeting at the Elysee Palace last week that President Emmanuel Macron had with young French people, that he talked about Algeria. And it is alleged he made remarks saying that Algeria is ruled by a political military system, that they had totally rewritten their history. And allegedly, he said that Algerian history is based on a hatred of France. And he said the idea in Algeria is that France is the problem. Now, the Elysee Palace have not denied that the president made these remarks, have not confirmed that he made these remarks. But the idea that the French president would have, even within a small circle of invitees, the Elysee Palace, made these remarks about Algeria certainly would have caused some upset in Algiers.
So, Catherine, it was reported that France will sharply reduce the number of visas granted to people from Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia. How serious is this, and how will it affect the residents of these four countries?
It is very serious in lots of ways because these are three countries which account for a large number of illegal immigrants in France. And the French authorities are saying, look, we have a lot of these people come to our courts, we issue expulsion orders, but we're unable to return them. And just as an example, the first 6 months of this year, French courts ordered the expulsion of 7,731 Algerians. Now, to expel them, you have to get the approval of the Algerian authorities. And the Algerians only agreed to take 22 of those. So the French are saying, we've tried, we are really trying, and in particular, we're trying very hard to get the most dangerous ones sent back. And none of these three governments are playing ball. They're just not doing their part. They say they had no choice but to bring in these new regulations to reduce the number of visas.
Right. And how did these countries react to this news that their visas would be reduced?
Well, all three of them initially said, look, this isn't true. We've been doing our part. The one that has really reacted the most strongly, of course, has been Algeria, that called in the French ambassador to Algiers, said that they were very unhappy with this, said that this was really out of order for the French to do this. And then in the last, I would say, 72 hours, really escalated it and this new diplomatic crisis that we're into now.
When Macron was elected, is what, 4 or 5 years ago in 2017, mm-hmm. It was suggested that he represented a new generation of French politicians and politics, especially in the foreign policy arena, his relationship with Africa and, you know, the relationship with France's former colonies in the Maghreb. How has this relationship been panned out in the last 4 or 5 years?
There are very different relationships with different countries. And I take, for example, France's relationship with Rwanda. It really has been a relationship where the French have worked on their recognizing some of the excesses during the colonial period. And that's a very different relationship than France has with Algeria, particularly Algeria. We're coming up to the 60th anniversary of the end of the Algerian War of Independence. It's a very difficult relationship. And there hasn't been the full depth and breadth of the historical discussion about what went on in Algeria in the same way that it has done in parts of Africa. So when you look at Algeria and French relations, they are so scratchy, they are so raw still, that even the slightest word out of order or the slightest hint that there might be some sort of French, if you like, arrogance or supremacy towards Algeria, then the relationship can spin out of control very quickly.
France has been counting on support and cooperation from these Maghreb countries in regards to its operations in Mali. Does this rupture in relations amount to France shooting itself in the foot, so to say?
The French military aren't putting it like that. They say that it slightly impacts on their ability to be able to supply their troops who are stationed in northern Mali, but they say it will not affect operations. Clearly, the French did not think that the Algerian authorities were going to take this step because they only found out about this ban on French military aircraft when they put forward their flight plan first thing on Sunday morning. And this has been the route that French Air Force planes have taken regularly since Operation Barkhane started and even before that during these operations in the Sahel. On top of that, let's not forget that France depends a lot on Algeria on that border area. The southern Algerian border is a huge border when you're talking about illegal migration, with uncontrolled migration. You know, this is an area where the French really feel that they have to have some sort of dialogue with the Algerians.
That was Catherine Field, a reporter and analyst based in Paris.
Voice of America!
There's a new weapon against COVID-19 and it's in capsule form. VOA's Caroline Presciutti explains how it's a breakthrough and why other pills have been discovered that we haven't heard about.
A stark illustration of the new number of COVID deaths in the United States. 700,000 from the White House.
That is a striking, horrifying number of lives lost.
But now, new hope. A pill that drug company Merck says prevents the coronavirus from multiplying. So promising that the clinical trials were stopped early so more lives could be saved. Taken at the onset of the disease, the pill reduces the risk of hospitalization or death by half.
They could go to their pharmacy and take their medication the way they do other medicines. This would allow us to treat many more people much more quickly, and we trust much less expensively.
Dr. Caleb Hernandez is an emergency room doctor who also researches COVID drug discoveries. He says three other pills have been introduced, one that reduces the need for oxygen by threefold, but not under big pharmaceutical names. So they sit on a shelf without the money for FDA approval.
Our government isn't set up to spend the $500,000 to do these studies. We rely on private companies to bring things to the FDA. And that's why you're not going to see as much innovation as you could see.
Experts worry that Americans will rely more on this new pill and avoid vaccines that teach the body to make its own coronavirus antibodies. But for remote countries, pills may be easier to administer. Affordability and distribution are other factors, though. Hernandez hopes that some drug, any drug, will end the pandemic.
But all I can think about is seeing that look on your face.
He sings this tribute to a fellow doctor who quit the profession because he was burned out from COVID.
We've been going for almost 2 years now, fighting every day, watching people die. And I think it's difficult when people in the community don't believe you. They think that you're part of some conspiracy or you're exaggerating and making things up. And then you go to work and you have to pronounce multiple people dead.
Merck plans to seek approval for emergency use of the drug, which could take about 2 months. Carolyn Presciutti, VOA News.
Dubai's Expo 2020 World Fair opened its doors to the public on Friday of last week, with more than 190 countries exhibiting their culture and latest innovations. Expo 2020 Dubai is the first world expo to be held in the Middle East and the world's biggest in-person event this year outside of the Olympic Games. Economic experts predict that the event will draw 25 million tourists to Dubai in the upcoming 6 months. George Eid reports for VOA from Dubai.
The lavish ceremony included fireworks and music. Stars headlining the opening ceremony included Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli. The opening ceremony, which was streamed in more than 400 locations and public spaces around the United Arab Emirates, was also watched by millions across the globe. The fair was officially opened to the public on the 1st of October. Ruba Abu Salbi, a business owner in Dubai, was waiting for the event to happen for some time now and says it was beyond their expectations.
I think most people will share my views on such an amazing event, Dubai Expo 2020. From the yet unmatched opening amazing ceremony to the Expo Village the size of a city, to the gorgeous architectural work on each and every pavilion. Dubai wanted to send a message of love, peace, and prosperity to the world, and I think the message was clearly received. I personally was dazzled as I walked through the pavilions. People had hope. People wanted to share their innovations with me. People wanted to talk about their countries.
Rana Risha, a journalist covering the World Fair, toured some of the pavilions and says she was amazed.
The least that can be said about the opening ceremony is that it was magical. Guests and VIPs were welcomed into the majestic Al Wasl Dome. They were greeted by a row of traditional Emirati dancers and artists. The geometric shape of the expo is a triple flower because the expo carried three main themes: sustainability, mobility, and opportunities. Each country has its own beautiful pavilion. USA, for example, is using amazing technology, making visitors wonder whether the pavilion itself is moving or not.
The Expo 2020 World Fair gathers more than 190 countries showcasing their cultures and innovations inside the architecturally dazzling pavilions spread over 1,083 acres. Dubai's government has spent an estimated $7 billion on the project that took years of preparations. Senior economic expert Nasser Saeed explains that the Expo 2020 is set to boost the economy of Dubai even more.
The important thing about Dubai Expo is that it's a historical event. It's the first time it happens in the Arab world. And it's the first mega event since the pandemic started. Tokyo did not have physical presence. This will have massive physical presence. In terms of the economic benefits to Dubai, we're expecting Dubai economic growth to grow by about 3.1% this year, and therefore adding at least 1%, 1.5% to the growth rate. Much of this comes from increased spending from tourists, services, transport, and importantly, this is the difference with other expos, more than 70% are expected from outside the country.
Dubai hopes to attract 25 million visitors to Expo 2020 over the next 6 months and is looking forward to boost tourism and investment in the Emirate. This is George Aid reporting for VOA from Dubai.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is calling on Bangladesh authorities to conduct a prompt and thorough investigation into the murder of Rohingya activist Mohib Ullah while he was visiting a Cox Bazar refugee camp in Bangladesh earlier this week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, paid tribute to the prominent human rights defender, who she said spent his life fighting to end decades of discrimination against the Rohingya people. She said Mohib Ullah lost his life while seeking to restore his people's basic rights in Myanmar, including their rights to nationality, land, health, and education. Ullah was shot and killed by unknown assailants Wednesday in Kutupalong, the world's largest refugee camp, housing more than 800,000 Rohingya. The refugees fled there in August of 2017 to escape persecution and violence in Myanmar. The High Commissioner's spokesman, Rupert Colville, says the Rohingya are still waiting for justice and still waiting to return home. He says there has been an alarming increase in violence, criminality, and rising tensions among groups in the Kutupalong camp. He adds anti-Rohingya sentiment also has been rising within Bangladeshi communities.
Whoever was responsible for his murder, Mohib Ullah's death is a clear example of the insecurity in the camp and the apparent attempts to silence moderate civil society voices. The High Commissioner is calling for a prompt, thorough, and independent investigation, which should be conducted not only to identify and apprehend his killers and expose their motives, but also to define what measures are needed to better protect vulnerable civil society leaders while avoiding further securitization in the camps.
Colville says the High Commissioner understands the huge challenges Bangladesh faces in hosting Rohingya refugees. Nonetheless, Bachelet asserts Bangladesh must ensure the safety, protection, and basic rights of the refugees in Cox's Bazar. She says that also applies to Basanchar, a remote island where thousands of Rohingya have been relocated.
Meanwhile, in Myanmar itself, the situation of approximately 600,000 Rohingya who remain in Rakhine State remains dire, with many still confined in camps. Alleged violations include unlawful killings, arbitrary arrest and detention, and high levels of extortion.
Colville says it is regrettable the global spotlight has moved away from the plight of the Rohingya people. He says the High Commissioner is calling on the international community to do more to help the persecuted community, both in Bangladesh and in Myanmar. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And Greece has agreed to buy 3 state-of-the-art warships from France, boosting its military capabilities after a decade-long economic recession that cut its defense spending alone by nearly one half. The deal boosts Greece's military capabilities, but critics fear it may stoke further tensions between Greece and age-old foe Turkey, both of them NATO members. Anthi Karasava explains from Athens.
The $5 billion deal will provide Athens with 3 Belhara frigates and 3 Gowin corvettes, with an option for one more of each. Officials say the first vessels will be delivered as early as 2024, with the remainder shipped to Greece 2 years later. Vice Admiral Stelios Fenekos explains the importance of the French frigates. He says these are state-of-the-art ships that provide support for a whole host of activities, from minding submarines and drones to firing missiles. The frigates have the capability to oversee 800 key locations and act and react swiftly. With their addition to the Greek Navy, the entire stretch of the country's waterfront frontiers, from the northern tip of the Aegean to as far south as Cyprus, will be shielded closely, Fenekos says. The deal complements another lucrative agreement Greece announced last year to buy at least 18 fourth-generation Rafale fighter jets for $2.5 billion. These defense contracts have helped seal a strategic defense strategy between Greece and France. The Turkish government, for its part, says the deal violates international law. For Ankara, which has been at odds with Athens for years over the Aegean waterway that divides the two countries and the Eastern Mediterranean, the latest arms purchase is a game changer at its expense. George Filis, a professor of geopolitics in Athens, explains. The deals advance Greece's military capability significantly, putting them 10 to 15 years ahead of Turkey. And with Turkey facing arms embargoes from countries like the United States, the prospect of boosting its capabilities is limited. Turkey, Filis says, is clearly in a bind. Greece and Turkey have been at odds over air and sea rights in the Aegean for ages. Last year, the two countries came to the brink of war over competing claims to drilling rights in the Eastern Mediterranean. France sided with Greece's rights, sending warships to the region to challenge Turkey in a move that enraged President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Under the new deal, France will come to Greece's military aid if requested and under threat. Likewise, Greece will aid France in military operations in sub-Saharan territories France has vested interests in. With tensions brewing anew between Greece and Turkey, Filis says he fears the latest deal may only aggravate tense relations. There is no doubt that this deal is a major game changer in the region, and Turkey may move to test the limits and reflexes of this new strategic alliance, he says. There has to be vigilance, he warns. Greece's parliament votes on the agreement on Tuesday. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
And in other news, U.S. is calling China's flying of 16 warplanes over waters south of Taiwan a provocative military action. China sent 38 warplanes into the area on Friday and 39 aircraft on Saturday, the most in a single day since Taiwan began releasing reports on the flights in September 2020. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. A new study provides evidence that Earth's brightness has dimmed over the past 20 years due to global warming caused by climate change. Rick Pantaleo joins us with Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
A study in the American Geophysical Union's journal, Geophysical Research Letters, provides evidence that Earth isn't shining as brightly as it did 20 years ago. Study authors propose that a 0.5% dip in what is known as albedo or Earth shine is being caused by warming oceans due to the effects of global climate change. The study suggests that the warming oceans are producing fewer clouds to reflect the sun's light. Scientists say this causes Earth to absorb more solar radiation, meaning more of the sun's energy is being caught up in the climate system. The paper's lead author, Philip Good, from the New Jersey Institute of Technology, says researchers analyzed data gathered from 1998 to 2017 by California's Big Bear Solar Observatory and various satellite measurements. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Voice of America!
In the Philippines, terrorism experts say that suicide terrorism has become the most common of the violent attacks by pro-ISIS elements in the country. There has been a marked increase in terror groups using children as suicide bombers. But that is just one of the ways that terror attacks have evolved in the Philippines and in the Southeast Asia since the 2017 Marawi siege and 20 years after the 9/11 attacks in the U.S. Stanley Gajete has more from Manila, Philippines.
20 years ago, the September 11 attack in the United States of America paved the way in the war on terror against Islamist militants in the Philippines. When the U.S. Army soldiers were assigned in the southern part of the Philippines, particularly in Sulu and Basilan, they were tasked to defeat the extremely violent Abu Sayyaf group. But two decades after, where is the Philippines in the war against the Islamist groups? Would the Taliban's victory in Afghanistan affect the current situation in the Philippines? Are groups like Abu Sayyaf, the BIFF, and remnants of the Maute group get inspiration from the Taliban? Counterterrorism experts from the Philippines, Ramel Banlawi and Yusuf Morales, explained how these small and radical Islamist forces in the southern Philippines are evolving and depicting the strength and victory of the Taliban.
Now we are monitoring how the Abu Sayyaf group will behave in the during the return of the Taliban in Afghanistan. And the latest picture that I got indicating that the fighters on the ground are becoming younger.
While the terrorist groups in the Philippines are usually unschooled and coming from rural areas, most of their members are now tech-savvy fighters. Members are usually from Generation Z, and they are more adapted to the situation by using social media as a tool to connect with other radical groups and build alliances in the Middle East, North Africa, and elsewhere, including in neighboring Indonesia and Malaysia.
The Abu Sayyaf group particularly has evolved from banditry to terrorism to crime terrorism nexus. So they have also experienced several waves of terror, and now we are experiencing a new wave of terror, especially in the context of the return of the Taliban.
Professor Yusuf Morales has seen suicide bombings carried out by foreigners, including women and children.
Radicalization happens because there are channels to radicalization that allows a person to connect and seek meaning. Poverty is not the only driving factor. Sometimes it is the quest for meaning. Sometimes it is ideological. Sometimes it is family. Sometimes it is social connections. And at other times it is engagements.
According to the 2020 Global Terrorism Index, the Philippines is still among the 10 most dangerous countries in the world. Experts believe that the slow rehabilitation of the damaged Marawi city due to ISIS groups in 2017 could contribute to the radicalization of young Muslims in the south. Experts said the Philippines would brace for possible suicide attacks in the south in the next few months. For VOA News, I am Stanley Buenafigete in Manila, Philippines.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great week ahead.